From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we are recording in front of a live audience on the near south side of Milwaukee. It is Lake Effect on site from Latino Arts at the city's Walker Square neighborhood.
We will be joined by journalist Adam Carr, whose city tours have given Milwaukeeans greater insight into the Cream City. Plus, Celia Benton and Jonathan Zuniga from the Layton Boulevard West Neighbors will discuss their organization and the communities in which they work.
Later, we'll talk to one of the two owners and operators of Purple Door Ice Cream.
Local author and essayist Mel Miskimmon talks about her new manuscript and her experiences growing up in Milwaukee's near South Side.
Plus, we'll have some music from Latino Arts' finest guitarists, and we'll talk to the director of the school's strings program, Denora Marquez.
Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I am Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We are on Milwaukee's near south side for our Lake Effect on-site series, recording in front of an audience at Latino Arts, located in the city's Walker Square neighborhood.
The neighborhood is part of the more general area known by several names, among them the moniker the near south side. It's an area that's near and dear to the heart of our first guest. Adam Carr wears a lot of hats, among them journalist, tour guide, and artist.
Some years ago, he was one of the artists behind a project that spotlighted the uniqueness of the Mitchell Street corridor, and he's kind of the perfect person to get our conversation going. Adam Carr, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So let's get one big issue out of the way first. What do we call this part of town, the part of town that kind of surrounds us? How do we describe the kind of area that we're in?
Sure, I think people take neighborhood names very seriously and very personally. So I just want to qualify, if you're in the audience right now or listening at home and you have any issues with what I say, you can write M. Tyke. Care of. So just kidding. I've heard the term near south side. And actually, I don't know when near south side started coming into existence, but it is a more recent phenomenon. I've heard very long time Southsiders say, what does near south side mean? What does that mean? Very specifically where we're sitting right now, we're at the United Community Center. Because we are west of the highway, that puts us in Walker Square, the Walker Square neighborhood. On the other side of the highway is Walker's Point. So then Walker's Point is a neighborhood, and I actually think there has been some work on the part of Walker Square to clearly delineate this side of the highway as being different than Walker Square, given the recent wave of development that's been happening in Walker's Point. Another more recent phenomenon also has been the Inner Harbor, now the Harbor District, which is bordering basically Walker's Point to its east. You go west of here, you got Clark Square, Masego Way, Silver City, Burnham Park, Layton Park. You could go over to Lincoln Village, also then the KK River Parkway neighborhoods. So that was a lot of neighborhoods all at once, but the near south side is a place of neighborhoods.
I mean, I wonder if there was a need to create a name like the near south side to kind of distinguish the part that's sort of closer to downtown than, you know, the south side really goes on for a long time. I mean, you're in Milwaukee until you get to the airport.
Absolutely, yeah. I sort of call that for myself, my shorthand is the deep south side. I think that kind of begins, it depends again, these are neighborhoods, I think they're much more a term of art than of science than we give them credit for. Neighborhoods are constructions, in my opinion. But KK River, you might consider the border of the near versus the further south side, or Oklahoma. I feel like once you get on the other side of Oklahoma, there's some substantial changes. Yeah, and I think the near south side, something that ties it together, and I would definitely not claim authorship of this idea, but it really has been the Ellis Island of Milwaukee.
I was going to say, has this always been a melting pot? Has this been a place where waves of immigrants have come to make a home here?
Absolutely. You know, I was just out in the lobby of the UCC, and they have a great depiction, a small model of a tannery. And the tannery points that there were Central and Eastern European folks here in the early 20th century when the first Mexican immigrants came up to work at the Pfister and Vogel tannery. And actually, I mean, as we know this in Milwaukee, is oftentimes subsequent waves of immigrants can have adversarial or competitive relationships. So the first Mexican families that came to Milwaukee were brought here unbeknownst to them to break a strike. So the Near South Side, so Latino immigrants have come here, and I think if you haven't updated your knowledge or your account of what's happened on the Near South Side in a while, the Near South Side continues to be the Ellis Island as we are now one, two, three, four generations deep into Mexican folks being in Milwaukee. If you look around, there are Burmese people, actually the Puerto Rican folks have started moving not to the sort of River West Harambe area, but down to the South Side, and I think that will be an increasing phenomenon of the Near South Side. But you have Northern African, South Asian immigrants, you have lots of different folks who have still come here as first and second wave immigrants.
Why here versus any place else in town?
That's a good question. I myself am a recent South Side transplant, and I think I grew up on the East Side and I moved to the South Side, and I think part of it is there are great homes here. I think the fact that it has been, when you have that kind of that identity of a part of town, that it is a place where immigrants feel comfortable, where different languages are spoken, that, like, go to South Division High School. I mean, that is the most international high school in our state. I think that that spirit persists across people. I also think, you know, I think the immigration, most people would agree, is kind of an act of optimism. And with people who are immigrants also often comes a very entrepreneurial spirit. And I knew this before I moved to the South Side, but I see it and hear it every day. People hustle really hard on the South Side, so I think people have that kind of that resonance with other folks who have come here before them.
Were your friends surprised you moved down here?
No. I don't think so. I do. I will say the South Side is near and dear to me, and I will say I've only been here a few years, so if there are any lifetime Southsiders in the crowd, they're definitely looking at me right now and thinking, that's an East Sider that just moved to the South Side.
So I have the Brewers hat on, at least.
Yeah, I wear a Brewers hat. So if you're at home listening, I'm wearing a Brewers hat. It's one of the many hats I wear. It's usually just a Brewers hat. So,
is there kind of an underdog mentality to the Near South Side?
Yeah, I definitely think that, like, an underdogness definitely comes with the South Side. I heard someone say one time, they described to me where they've lived, and it was like all over the country, but they said, but I've been on the South Side my whole life. Like, they bring it with them, you know? Like, so I think there definitely is an element of, like, that being, you know, an underdog part of the culture.
Do you find that people have surprising ideas about people who live here? I mean, when you're doing your tours, when you talk to people who either did not grow up here, don't live here, what are the misconceptions that they might have of this area?
That's a good question. I think, to me, something that I think is a recent phenomenon, if there's a headline to the census, the 2020 census for the South Side of Milwaukee, is that the South Side continues to change. Not only are there subsequent waves of immigrants coming here, but also migrants. And by that I mean there are more and more African-American folks who are either moving up from the North Side of Milwaukee or Chicago who continue adding layers to what the South Side is. So I think some folks will have an impression of the South Side that maybe they updated 20 years ago, but the South Side keeps changing. And if you haven't been down Chavez Drive or Mitchell Street, or you haven't been on South 13th Street or up on National in the last 5 years, what you'll find is probably different than what you expect.
When we were talking about names, you were talking about how there's been kind of a concerted effort to distinguish the Walker Square neighborhood from what's across the freeway in Walker's Point. How is what's happening nearby in places like Walker's Point influencing the places to the west, like where we are now?
That's a good question. I mean, I've heard varying accounts of this. Like, for example, the city came out with a gentrification report last year saying that there hasn't been a tremendous amount of gentrification in Walker's Point, because that implies gentrification is understood with displacement as well. And a lot of the developments that have happened in Walker's Point have happened in underutilized spaces or largely vacant spaces. I do think, though, I mean, there's certainly a feeling of nervousness as the whole Milwaukee housing market changes, that people who have been Southsiders for generations might no longer be able to afford rents here, might not be able to afford to buy here. That said, there are actually, as was said in the introduction, there are many people, Latino homeowners in the neighborhood, who would stand to gain by rising housing prices. So I do think the wave of development happening in Walker's Point, for me, the litmus test that exists for gentrification is it extraction, right? Are the people who are gaining from it largely from somewhere else, or are there people on the inside track? Because there are Latino business owners in Walker's Point who have been in the winners column, but the question is, like, if you aggregate all that, who's winning, who's losing, who's missing out?
Is there an untold story of the Near South Side that we should know?
You know, I would say my favorite place, as you mentioned when you introduced me, to hear stories of the South Side, and this is kind of an old-fashioned thing, is the commercial corridors. So if you were to go to the main streets of the South Side, whether that be Mitchell Street or Lincoln, there are incredible businesses that represent different cultures from around the world who are based there. So for example, on Mitchell Street, up until about a year ago, they had a business on Mitchell Street representing every single inhabited continent on Earth. So, and here's, so South America, Northern Africa, they have a Somali store, Europe, Asia. They had an Australian resale shop, which recently closed. But they also have the Gerald L. Ignace Indian Wellness Center, so they had indigenous people from North America who could claim presence on Mitchell Street. So I think that's amazing. Recently, I actually went on a little walking expedition with some students on Lincoln Avenue, and we went into a couple of the shops, and I didn't realize there were two different Burmese shops on Lincoln, as well as a really cool airbrush t-shirt place. And so I think the untold stories of Mitchell Street, so, you know, I think people tell those stories in some communities, right? But I think the main streets and the businesses and what entrepreneurs are doing in those spaces from whatever background they're coming from, I think are some of the most amazing stories of the South Side. And that includes some of the legacy ones like AJ Polish Deli or Nagel Awning or some of the places that have been around forever. I can now go on like the Lao Thai restaurants that are up in Silver City. And then also the new cafes coming. I don't want to step on the next guest.
Well, yeah, we should probably, this is probably a perfect place to transition here. There are three key neighborhoods that our next guests work in. The Layton Boulevard West Neighbors Organization does community development work in Burnham Park, Layton Park, and Silver City. Celia Benton is the group's economic development director, and Jonathan Zuniga is director of outreach and engagement. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being here. In some parts of town, we think of neighborhood organizations as the people who organize the trick-or-treating or the block parties. What is the role that LBWN plays in these three neighborhoods in which you function?
Well, we still organize the trick-or-treating and the block parties.
Well, of course, yeah.
But, you know, Lady Boulevard West Neighbors is a community development organization, like I mentioned, focused in Silver City, Burnham Park, and Lane Park, so around between the Menominee Valley, Lincoln Avenue, and Lane, the historic Lane Boulevard to the Miller Parkway. And we do all sorts from economic development, housing development, and community building, from the trick-or-treating events, trick-or-treat street on National Avenue, some, you know, commercial redevelopment along National Avenue as well, to park renovation. So it's a very mix of things.
What does economic development look like to you? Is it about making things better for the people who are already there, or doing things to bring other people to that part of town, or probably a little of both?
Yeah, absolutely a little bit of both. So one of the things that I focus on is, as Adam says, people hustle very hard in the neighborhoods we serve, and we know there's a lot of entrepreneurialism happening, and so part of our job is to help them grow and establish, you know, validate their plans and really thrive in the communities that they live in, and also to empower neighbors to take control alongside business owners in establishing the vision for commercial corridor development and implementing it as well. We do, of course, welcome, as Adam says, we're an international community. We welcome everybody to come down. All of the businesses I serve definitely want me to invite you to come down and just enjoy the neighborhoods as well.
Well, so how does what you do relate to what's going on in other parts of the cities? Are there similar organizations to yours that are operating that you might partner with?
we, our whole existence is around partnerships. We partner with neighbors, we partner with business owners, but there are a ton of amazing organizations doing very similar work around the near South Side, and I can certainly name some within the economic development world, and I'm sure I'll miss some, but the Multicultural Entrepreneurial Institute, the Hmong Chamber of Commerce, the Hmong American Women's Association, WIBIC, there's the Milwaukee Christian Center, Clark Square, our neighbors to the east, and it really just goes on and on. It's a series of neighborhoods of amazing people.
What are the chief challenges you encounter in trying to encourage investment in this part of town?
I would say from an internal perspective, Adam was talking earlier on, there's the sentiment with names of the neighborhood, right? So near Southside maybe doesn't tug at your heart, but when we start to acknowledge Silver City and its value, having that name kind of authenticates the value of your neighborhood. And one of the things that I think is important for neighbors to understand is the value of their own neighborhood, just by them being there, getting to know their neighbors, having a voice and controlling what happens, I think is a big hurdle towards implementing those visions. And
I was going to say, my understanding is that the city doesn't assign neighborhood names. It's up to the residents to come up with the names that they want, that reflect their neighborhood and who they feel they are. Is that correct? Is that?
Sort of.
I mean,
if you look, there are maps that exist where every inch of Milwaukee is covered with a neighborhood name, probably the majority, maybe vast majority of which aren't in popular usage by people. So sometimes people do get together and make a neighborhood name together and it becomes something very real. Sometimes it is kind of aspirational thing. So,
okay. And I would also say a lot of people would consider the South Side as a neighborhood. So, I mean, growing up here in the South Side, I never knew my neighborhood name, but I knew I was from the South Side of Milwaukee. But now I think as we do, all this work and engage residents, they start feeling proud of that neighborhood as well, whether it's Silver City or Burnham Park or Lane Park.
So for people who haven't spent much time in Burnham Park or Silver City or the whole Layton Boulevard West area, what are some of the success stories? What are the kinds of projects that LBWN has been involved in that you could see just from walking down the street or driving past?
Well, I can start on the north side and you can move down south. So most recently, the business owners along National Avenue and Pierce Street really wanted a way to welcome people to the community and to build more rapport with the neighbors living in the area. And what better way to do that than to show pride through new art installations? And so on the corner of 35th and National and 37th and Pierce, two new art installations created by a Silver City artist were placed there just to represent the amenities that we have. And Adam was talking about the diversity of the neighborhood. You can see all of that in these intricately designed mosaics that reflect the really unique cultural diversity and the manufacturing history, the history of play in the neighborhood, the native flora and fauna. And just, it's a beautiful representation of the sense of community that's growing. There's also quite a bit of economic development happening along National Avenue. So as Adam said, we do have quite a few well-established restaurants. Vientiane Noodle Shop, for example, has been there since 1997. They're one of the amazing stories of the refugee community from Laos coming to that neighborhood in Milwaukee. But people continue to want to be established in the neighborhood because they know they'll be welcomed. We have Orenda Cafe coming at 3514 West National Avenue in just a few days. I wish I could be more exact, but that was a formerly foreclosed on property, vacant and blighted for over 10 years, and the community said, we believe in the value of this building. We believe that, we deserve more amenities. We want something to serve our families, and so they encouraged Leticia, who's from the neighborhood, to establish that cafe there.
Celia Benton is the Economic Development Director, and Jonathan Zuniga is Director of Outreach and Engagement for Layton Boulevard West Neighbors, and Adam Carr is a journalist, artist, and Southsider. Thanks to all three of you.
Coming up next on the show, we will go from the west to the east and talk with the owner of a burgeoning ice cream empire based in Walker's Point. You're listening to Lake Effect On Site from Milwaukee's NPR.
We're We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I am Bonnie North. We are coming to you from Latino Arts in the Walker Square neighborhood on Milwaukee's Near South Side. Just a few blocks east of where we are sitting is a storefront from which Dairy Delights emanate. It is a fairly unassuming spot at the corner of South 2nd and Pittsburgh, or Freshwater Way, depending on whether you're on the east or east or west side of the street. And that is where Purple Door welcomes ice cream lovers from around the region.
The business was the dream of Steve and Lauren Schultz, who have since expanded their local ice cream footprint to several other outfits around the area. Lauren Schultz joins these two ice cream lovers on the stage now. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So what made Walker's Point the right place for your business?
Yeah, so our business, when we started, we were just a little wholesale company. And so we kind of had a nice opportunity to look around the city of Milwaukee of where we thought would be a good fit for our ice cream shop. And when we toured a lot of places, and we came to Walker's Point, and it just seemed like a natural fit. What we wanted our ice cream shop to be is a welcoming place for everyone. And the community really is diverse, but mindful of the differences that people have, and they really embrace that. And that's kind of what we wanted our ice cream shop to embrace as well.
Were there people that cautioned you against this? This is ice cream in a frozen custard town?
Oh, yes. I would totally be lying if I said we were not nervous to open an ice cream shop in a custard town. But we were thoughtful about that and tried to really differentiate ourselves from custard. And also,
you do not have a flavor of the day.
No, we do not. People ask that. That's one of the number one questions when people call. I said, what's your flavor of the day? I said, well, we have 20, so come on down and see. But yeah, we were really thoughtful of kind of separating ourselves from custard and having a lot of different flavors, making a super premium ice cream, using the local ingredients from other food producers, a lot that are in the Near South Side area as well.
How did you go about learning the business even before your own shop? Were you just making ice cream at home and thought this would be a fun thing to do?
So the idea of having an ice cream business stems back to when I was a kid. And from the mere fact that I loved going out for ice cream. It was such a novelty for our family. It was, you know, a summer night. It was such a treat. And I thought it would be about the best job that there could be. People were happy when they got ice cream. So I talked about it for years and would make ice cream in my home kitchen. And then when I met my husband, on the first or second date, I told him about this crazy idea. We were both educators at the time. And I told him that one day I wanted to have an ice cream shop. And he was kind of the support and kind of the push behind it, said, well, you should try it. So yeah, we made it in our home kitchen. We decided we should learn a little bit about business. So we took a course with the Wisconsin Women's Business Initiative about how to write a business plan. And they were able to actually offer us our first small business loan to get things started.
And that was the wholesale part of it?
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When did the transition happen into retail? How long had you been doing the wholesale part?
We did wholesale for just a little over a year. And it was just us, you know, kind of going to grocery stores around the area. We did some farmers markets. We just wanted to get our ice cream in people's hands. We showed up at restaurants to see if anyone was interested. And we were very lucky. I mean, the city of Milwaukee really, really took to us and embraced us, very loyal followers of us. And so we actually moved into the Clock Shadow building. That was the first place where we had a small presence of a retail shop. That was in the cheese shop of Clock Shadow Creamery. And then shortly after that, about a year after that, we moved into our current location. And we're about to be there for 5 years. Mm-hmm.
Well, and so when did the idea of kind of pushing the flavor envelope come into this? Because I don't know how old you are, but when I was a kid and I went out for ice cream, the flavor, you know, even when you went to one of the places that had many flavors, the flavors were all kind of variations on a theme. They were not what you would find at Purple Door today.
There's a lot of ways that stems. One, that's the fun part about making ice cream, right? We always say you can put most anything in ice cream. It doesn't always taste good, but you can put anything in there. But when we started to seek out ingredients for ice cream, we met with a lot of local food producers, and their creations really helped us to say, okay, how can we push the envelope with our own ice cream? We also get a lot of recommendations from customers, which we love, things that they've tried at different parts of the world, parts of the country, when they were a kid. It's just this memory of this amazing ice cream they had sometime.
And you're doing a contest also, right?
Yes, this summer is the third time we'll be doing, we do it every other year, our flavor contest. And anyone can submit a flavor idea. We oftentimes get hundreds of them. And then we will pick 15 of those flavors and we'll make them. And then we have a big like block party community event where you can come and try the flavors. And then you vote on which one that you think is the best. And then that becomes a permanent flavor in our rotating line.
So there you go.
It's fun.
Start thinking of that.
Start thinking about that now.
The deadline is when?
It's on Father's Day this year.
Oh, okay.
Sunday,
okay.
June 16th.
But you have to get the ideas in before that, right?
Because yes, the ideas are due by the end of this month.
Okay.
All right. So a little time to think about that. But for you, since you have been tasting and making ice cream essentially all of your life, what makes a superlative ice cream to you? Is it a combination of things?
Absolutely. Yep. It's a combination of flavor, the taste that you get when you first put the ice cream in your mouth, and then what lingers as well. Its texture, it has to be smooth, has to be creamy, and then of course it has to be delicious.
Okay, so I have to ask, I mean, you've pushed the flavor envelope, you like trying new things. Mm-hmm. For every flavor that ends up on the menu, how many end up on the cutting room floor?
That's a good question. there's been some that have not turned out well.
Do you want to name names?
I was going to say.
So we've done some, we actually, this was a flavor contest one, was a sriracha flavor. Some people loved it.
An acquired taste, as they say.
Uh-huh,
right?
Yes. We've done some that you think would be really good, and then they turn out like really, really sweet, and you can't even handle it in your mouth. We've gotten pretty good at balancing out and kind of guessing as to what should go in the ice cream when we're developing flavors, but sometimes they still take us by surprise.
One of the things that I've heard is that something like vanilla is actually really, really difficult to do well, mm-hmm. because everyone thinks it's easy. Mm-hmm. Is that, do you find that true? To do a really good vanilla, a really good chocolate, the basic flavors?
Absolutely. Those are the ones that take the longest to create. I mean, we've been doing them since the inception of our company, but in order to have a good ice cream shop, you have to have an amazing vanilla. You have to have an amazing chocolate. And so we really stand by those as well. But it took quite a long time to develop those and to find, especially with the chocolate, finding the cocoa that has the right butter fat with the mixture of water that goes in it, and there's a lot involved with it to get the correct balance.
Right now, a favorite flavor that you're going back to?
Oh, there was one from last summer that I loved, sour passion fruit orange. It's really delicious.
Sounds delicious. Mm-hmm. Mm.
All right, well, Lauren Schultz, one of the owners of Purple Door Ice Cream, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up in just a moment, from tasty treats to tasty pros, writer Mel Miskimmon joins us when we return to our Lake Effect on-site, recorded right here at Latino Arts on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect On-Site continues on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. We are at Latino Arts on Milwaukee's Near South Side in the Walker Square neighborhood. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Mel Miskimmon is a big fan of this neighborhood. The writer and humorist has called this part of town home for quite some time, and it shows in her writing. In fact, it'll show a lot in her next book, which stars her very own South Side house.
Miskimmon is also the author of two other books, Cop's Kid and Sit, Stay, Heal, and her essays have appeared in numerous places, including both national publications and here on Lake Effect. Mel Miskimmon, welcome back to the show. It's great to see you.
Thank you. Thank you. This is so much fun.
I know. It's been a while.
And you've only been on stage for like 15 seconds.
I know.
It's going to get better.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay.
So how long have you lived in this part of town?
I have lived here for, I always get this wrong because it was like right when we got married and I can never remember that. 35 years? Yeah.
Fortunately, you got married when you were four.
That's right, yes, child bride. Okay. Yeah.
So what kept you here? What makes this...
I grew up on the South Side around El Verno College. That's another part of the South Side. And when it came time for my husband and I to buy a house, we were big fans of this old house with Bob Vila back in the day. And we thought, yeah, let's do that. So we traveled around the city and looked at houses, and we saw an ad for a house in, you remember those Home Shoppers that used to be in the stores, in the grocery stores? Well, we saw this house and it said, partially restored Victorian double city lot, pool, and outbuildings. So we were like, yes, let's do that. Well, the outbuildings was a rusted shed, and the pool was a deflated kiddie pool that had been draped over the shed like a Salvador Dali painting. But when we toured the house, it seemed so desperate. It was like, come on, this is it for me. This is the end of the line. If you people don't buy me, it's just going to be aluminum siding, you know. So... We bought the house, and with good intentions of renovating it, I thought it would take us like 5 years, maybe tops. Well, it's been 30 some years, and we're still renovating. And I'm not a very patient person. What
is the kiddie pool gone?
The kiddie pool is gone. Yes. Yeah. When we moved in, there was also this wire wheel that they used as a picnic table that we made the mistake of putting out in the alley, which was like a siren song for everyone to bring their debris and then pile it on top of our debris. So it was. We learned quickly not to do that.
As Adam Carr said in the very seat where you are sitting right now, the neighborhood has evolved a great deal. Mm-hmm. What's kept you here? I mean, does it somehow, even as things change, continue to feel like you?
Well, I'm not a very patient person. So in the beginning of our renovating, I was beating my head against the wall. Like, I wanted it to be like the next East Side, you know, with cute little boutiques of the way I wanted it to be. And so I wasn't allowing the neighborhood to breathe. I felt like I was forcing it into this pigeonhole. And it took me years before I finally got an epiphany that the authenticity of the neighborhood is what is its strength, you know? And I just finally, I don't know, I just came to terms with it. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean like, you know, like you say, you grew up. I did. I grew up here in so many ways. So I love it.
How does the place feed you as a writer? Because you've written a few books here and more than a few essays.
Well, I think that in every neighborhood that you've been in a while, you get to know your neighbors. Maybe you don't get to know them personally, but you have like there's characters in every block, and our block certainly has its share of characters, and we've had our share of events that have brought the neighborhoods out in their pajamas in the alley because of some incident that we all bond over, you know, as we're all out in our various nightwear. But no, it's never been dull. We've raised two children here. I've managed to stay married. Oh, geez, I don't know how that happened. But I would not have traded it for any other neighborhood because I sometimes feel that other neighborhoods are too antiseptic. I feel like I said, this neighborhood is authentic, and the people are fantastic. They are real. You know, and sometimes there's a language barrier, but you can always wave. You can always smile. I just love it. I love it.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about what your current writing project is and share a little with us?
Yeah, sure. I it took me 35 years, and I thought I had this story about, you know, us two young kids in love. buying this old house and fixing it up, and especially in today's world where you've got this, you know, this cable TV where people manage to renovate an entire house in 28 minutes. You know, how is this with these astronomical budgets?
With commercial breaks.
Yeah. So I, if you would indulge me, I could read a little snippet of this new book I'm writing. It's called, tentatively called, Housebroken: Stories of Romance, Renovation, and Regret. That's my working title. Oh, and also it coincides with me meeting my husband. I met my husband and got married, and we bought this house like in very close proximity. So, okay. I had known him for only 8 hours when I proposed. He wasn't even my type. I had been attracted to men in need of major renovating, emotional walls torn down for better flow. I had assumed articles, "You Can't Change Him," had been written for someone else. But this guy, he was different from any other man I had been with. He was nice. I would say he was move-in ready. Lust had never lasted. Maybe nice would have more staying power. Did I think he would have accepted my offer? No, but he did, so we got married. Conventional 1980s real estate wisdom would have put the newly wedded us in a so-called starter home situated in a neighborhood populated with people like ourselves, not in a house with 13 pages of code violations. Minor details when you're in love. The house stood on a steep and difficult to mow without bodily harm hill, as did most of the houses on that side of the street. She was painted a dull and depressing gray. The unevenly applied red accents to her trim looked like she tried to put lipstick on while riding in the back car of a roller coaster. How had she managed to escape being smothered with aluminum or vinyl siding? Back when the bicycle was a newfangled fad, and electricity had yet to be taken for granted, and Benjamin Harrison was president, she must have been a real stunner. But now, she looked like an aging movie star on the cover of The Inquirer, caught coming out of Costco. Had this been an episode of This Old House, the host, Bob Vila, would have supplied us with a backstory about the history of the property. He would have summarized the cons: busy street, traffic noise, and then he would have rattled off the pros: lot size, convenient location to mass transit, not to mention Major League Baseball. He would have brought up the fact that most of the interior woodwork and exterior clapboards were intact, and then he would have told the viewing audience what the plan for the house would be. Total gutting, I assumed. He would have closed out the episode with a promise to see us next time. The real estate agent wants to know if we had any questions. Oh, I did. What made the claw marks on the back of the attic door? Whose idea was it to use indoor-outdoor carpeting as a wall covering? Who built the house? Did anyone die in it? How come there weren't any fireplaces? Had her beauty slowly faded, or had it been abruptly taken during a weekend reno frenzy? Were the mushrooms growing under the basement stairs edible? My husband Mark had only one question: how much? 41.9, the real estate agent said. See if they'll take 35, Mark said. I looked around. There was no Bob Vila, no Norm Abrams, just me and Mark. We were by no means experts, but we were a team, legally bound to each other for better or worse, till death. Hopefully the house wouldn't kill us. Thanks.
Mel Miskimmin reading from her forthcoming book. Remind me again, it was a long title, and my memory is not so great.
Which one? This one?
This one.
Yes.
Oh, this one, it's called Housebroken.
Yeah. I guess it wasn't that long a title.
Maybe. I don't know.
There was like a part after the colon.
Just never mind.
Yeah. It'll change.
You'll come back and see us when it is out.
Oh, yeah, I will. Sure.
All right. Mel Miskimmin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We will take one last break, and then on to the musical portion of our program, or continued musical portion of our program. We'll be back with Denora Marquez and our two guitarists when Lake Effect Onsite returns on WUWM.
Lake Effect Onsite from Latino Arts continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Our next guests are integral members of the musical life here at Latino Arts. Denora Marquez is the founder of the national award-winning Latino Arts String Program. Just three of the program's awards included being recognized by the National Association of Music Merchants, or NAM, as a best community for music education in the country from 2012 to 2017.
In 2015, Marquez received Wisconsin's Martin Luther King Heritage Award, and in 2014, Latino Arts String Program won a visit from the John Lennon bus and was featured in the NAM Music Education National Conference.
And I have to say, if you've never had a chance to hear her student groups perform, you should run, not walk, to hear them. They are that good. Denora's also been a pretty regular guest on Lake Effect over the past decade, so it is a pleasure to see you again. Thanks so much.
It's so wonderful to be here with you. Thank you.
So when did the string program start, and what was the impetus for beginning it?
Well, the string program started actually as a dream. Once I graduated from UWM with a master's degree in string pedagogy, I was looking for a place to take this dream. And the dream was founded in the fact that I was a child immigrant to the United States when I was 10 years old. And not speaking a word of English at the time, music became my language. So I landed in a place where there was a marvelous music teacher. It gave me an instrument, and there became my voice until I finally learned to speak English. So what I was looking for was for a place to give that back. And I came to the United Community Center, I think it was in 2000, for an exhibit that was given by my husband, Raul Diel, for their annual dinner. And I don't know if you've been to the annual dinner at the United Community Center. It's a really wonderful event, and you really get to see everything that's happening in the agency. And it just looked like an amazing place to start something where I felt like, okay, these are my people, this is where I can give back what I was given as a child. So it all took a little while, but finally we got it started in 2002. And I remember when I was doing the interview, one of the people that was interviewing me said something like, you seem really ambitious. I'm like, you have no idea. No, but really, I said, no, really, what I see here is in our community is an incredible amount of talent. And I think children in general, but of course I was focused in my community and a community of immigrants, and having been a child immigrant, I was focused on what could happen when a fertile ground of immigrant youth were given the opportunity to really develop their talents.
Well, and so for people who aren't familiar with it, what are the ensembles that exist and who participates? How old are the players?
Well, the program can start a young person as early as 5 years old, depends on the instrument. We teach entirely string instruments, violin, viola, cello, bass, classical guitar, and a variety of folk guitar instruments. The premise is that we can develop our classical European techniques through the development and knowledge of Latin American music. And so, like I said, the children can be as young as 5 years old if they're on violin. And we started with 26 students, and now we have about 200 students. We started with just myself as the instructor, and now we have 10 part-time instructors that work with me. Including the gentleman that you're going to hear in just a few minutes. We started with just violin and viola, and now we have all the instruments that I told you. And we continue to support the students through high school, actually beyond, because now that we have about 8 students studying music at UWM and Lawrence University, We continue to mentor them and support them with the possibility of continuing their careers, either as musicians or as teachers or directors. And hopefully, I've always said that one of our graduates is going to take my place and allow me to retire someday. So it looks like it might happen.
Do you consider yourselves ambassadors for your community and for the greater community here?
I think that's a great way to define it. And it's also a way in which young people are empowered to do what they're doing. So I explained that we do European classical music training, but there's a very strong philosophy to what we do in which our students get heritage education through the study of music from all over Latin America. So you asked if what were the ensembles that we have. Everybody thinks that what we have here is a mariachi program. And that is not entirely true. I mean, we do have ensembles that we call mariachis, but they're not even traditionally set up like a mariachi. What they really are is several levels of chamber orchestras that play music from all over Latin America. Just recently, we were invited to perform at a conference here in Milwaukee, and the reason they asked for the group is because they saw videos in which we didn't just play mariachi music. We played tangos from Argentina, we played cuecas from Bolivia, we played parrandas from Puerto Rico, we played cumbias from Colombia, and that's really wonderful, and it's part so that all our students that represent all these various countries can see themselves in the music that they play, their families can see themselves included in this artistic expression, right? So then what we have is then four levels of what we call our mariachi programs. We have a budding guitar program that is actually, it's not budding, it has quite a few students, but what's new about it is we're really trying to establish a guitar orchestra. And we have a cello choir that's, it plays almost entirely European classical music. We have a violin choir that focuses on European classical music. But the other ensembles that go out into the community that work as ambassadors perform all this music from Latin America. And it's beautiful. It's really beautiful to see the children walk out there and just own spaces that they normally would not be a part of, right? And I think over the past 17 years, those spaces have been opened up. And now they see themselves pretty much anywhere in town, not just in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a perfect time to bring in our two gentlemen who've been performing so beautifully all evening. We have closest to me, Carlos Serrano, and then Joan Ruiz, both guitar instructors in the program.
That's correct.
And also have been instrumental, no pun intended, in helping create the Guitar Summit, which has been going on, what now, 5 years, is that
six
about?
Years.
6 years, yeah. And that is focusing, again, on that European classical tradition, but also the Latin American guitar tradition, which is so rich.
Exactly. I'd like for John to talk a little bit more about it, but it is in fact true that we founded the Guitar Festival 6 years ago, and a strong focus is the fact that guitar repertoire does focus so much on Latin American music. But John is now coordinating the festival, so.
So I've been the guitar coordinator for 4 years, and it's been a pleasure for me being with our team, and then also being teaching all like around 50 students that are doing classical guitar, and it's beautiful to see that they are doing classical guitar, but as well Latin American music. You know, kids, they love to play music, folklorical music from their, well, you know, for the culture, and it's really good to be part of it. So the program is growing a lot, and then every festival is getting better.
And this last year, we also had jazz, too. Didn't you add jazz to it? Because there's certainly a lot of Latin jazz. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
well.
So every year for the festival, we try to bring something new for the students. Last year, we did flamenco. This year, we add some jazz because we have one of our teacher is amazing at jazz and classical guitar. So why not include that? So we try to teach them as much as we can from different cultures. The classical guitar, it has so much Latin American composers. So it kind of connect, everything connect very well.
When it comes to getting students enthusiastic about it, I mean, how much do they know about the classical tradition when they come in, and how much do you have to kind of explain it to them and get them to be excited? You know, they're kids. The kids don't always like to practice their instruments.
Well, I think the excitement doesn't necessarily have to happen with the practice. I think they do come in quite excited. It was surprising to me that even the first generation was excited to start something. And we do have a very strong focus on high quality. So the students are expected to practice daily, are expected to fulfill certain requirements. But I think that what really gets a child excited is the accomplishment, right? So yes, it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of, you know, scaling up, no pun intended. but as soon as they see themselves performing, successfully performing, it just really nurtures their soul, right? You will ask almost any of our graduates, and they have this phrase they like to use. It's like, music gave me my voice. And they don't like to speak in public, so they really mean that this is what's happening for them. What do you think, Carlos?
Something that we use a lot is we tend to be an example for them as much as we can. We also take them to events, classical guitar events, either from UWM, the Guitar Society, even here. When we have an artist, they have to come, or we try to take them to the events so they can witness what the professionals do already. Not just us, not just the people around in the community, which we have a lot of good guitarists around here, but people from all over the world. So that's something inspiring for them, and it gives them an idea of what they can achieve if they really try. So that incentive enables them to try harder and harder every week and come to the lesson better prepared and come to the lesson more eager to learn. So far that has worked quite wonderful in the past 2 years that I've been here.
Well, we are running out of time, and I want to hear a little music. So if we can get you to go back over and play us out, that would be just a fabulous thing.
That is all the time we have for our Lake Effect On-Site today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I am Bonnie North. Muchas gracias por su tiempo esta noche, señoras y señores.
Big thanks to Latino Arts for having us here, along with our engineer, Jason Reavy, Christine Lamatina, and Michelle Matanowski from WUWM for making this show possible, and the entire great studio audience we had tonight.
That's right. Give yourselves a round of applause. Mitch and I produce Lake Effect On-Site and all of our in-studio shows, along with Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski, who deserve a round of applause back over there, too. We get also help from assistant producer Maddie Andre, digital producer Lauren Sigfusson, plus our intern Zoe Munson.
Thank you so much for being here and for tuning in, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.